Film Spotting is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
And by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free. Join now at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. This week, which battle will be more bloody and brutal? Batman versus Bane or Michael Phillips versus A.O. Scott? We'll discuss The Dark Knight Rises and enlist the help of the dynamic former At the Movies duo to debate Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Do you think A.O. Scott will let me call him Tony?
If you're lucky.
That's all I care about. We'll also count down our top five stormy weather movies. These are films like Beasts of the Southern Wild that feature a major meteorological event or threat.
The Film Spotting Doppler 9000 is getting fired up as we speak. But first, what are you?
I'm Christopher Nolan's Reckoning.
That sounded very accurate.
There's a storm coming.
You sound like you're looking forward to it.
I'm adaptable.
I'm Gotham's Reckoning.
Did they kill him?
I'm not sure.
Huh? Why didn't you just kill me?
Your punishment must be more severe.
Do you think he's coming back?
I don't know.
Why would you run, Bane?
You should be as afraid of him as I am.
I won't bury you. I've buried enough members of the Wayne family.
You don't owe these people anymore. You've given them everything.
Not everything. Not yet.
My mother warned me about getting into cars with strange men.
This isn't a car.
Like Bruce Wayne, who at the start of The Dark Knight Rises has holed up in his mansion, out of public view, I've sequestered myself in a virtual Batcave the past few days, avoiding any news, reviews, or tweets about the movie until I'd seen it, which, Adam, we both did just a few hours ago. My reasoning went beyond trying to avoid plot spoilers. It was also an attempt to modulate my expectations. The Dark Knight, the preceding film in Christopher Nolan's Batman series before this one, his last, is a masterpiece of the genre. And I wanted to allow some breathing space for this finale to be taken on its own terms. And so my disappointment with The Dark Knight Rises is something I don't want to give too much credence to. Don't get me wrong, this is a very good film, a worthy installment in the series, and one of the better superhero movies of the last few years. Yet there's also a nagging conventionality to it, especially in the way it ends, that has left me, well, simply satisfied. Maybe that should be enough. Is it fair, Adam, to so closely compare these two Dark Knight films? Instead, should I be completely setting aside the ways that Rises falls a bit short in my mind and just enjoy the many things it does so well?
Well, I'd love for you to be able to put aside your feelings for The Dark Knight and appreciate The Dark Knight Rises more, because I think you're really underrating it based on what comments you've made up to this point. And I think the only way you can really describe this movie at all as conventional is if you set The Dark Knight on such a pedestal that you think that it alone defines those conventions, because I can't compare this to any other superhero film I've seen other than The Dark Knight. And actually, for me, it does some things I appreciate more than that film. We'll talk about maybe just a little bit, because we certainly don't want to give anything away, the ending. I think what you're confusing with conventionality is actually just the fact that it really ties up nicely. And I don't think the fact that it ties up really, really effectively and satisfactorily necessarily spells conventionality. But I guess I do want to get out of the way here at the top, this notion everyone's going to do it with the trilogy. They're going to kind of want to know where this slots in relation to the other film. And for me, I'm actually grateful. I haven't seen either of the first two movies since I saw them in the theater. So it's been 4 years or whatever since I saw The Dark Knight. I've moved on the way I think Nolan and company have moved on, and this movie can stand on its own, and it certainly did for me.
I guess maybe I should explain a little more by what I mean by conventional. I found this to be much more franchise serving than the other films. What I really loved right from the get-go about Nolan's getting a hold of this is that he seemed like he was not beholden to any other studio dictates or character dictates. We didn't see Batman's costume. We didn't get the money shot for the first hour of this franchise. And to me, that was so bold, so against type, that I was really excited about someone doing what he wanted with this character. And that continued, I felt, with The Dark Knight in different ways. Here, The Dark Knight Rises, it seemed like there was more conventional service, especially in how it handles the ultimate fate of Batman and Bruce Wayne. There's a lot of careful setting up of the future of the franchise, which I did not expect, and I think gets in the way of the overall story. No. And in some ways, all of this kind of amounts to this being the most compromised of the three. So I'm not saying, again, that it's bad in the ranking. I think it's probably the least successful, but still, like I mentioned, one of the better superhero films.
Well, for me, as I said, I'd definitely put it above Batman Begins, and I'd put it up there with The Dark Knight. And it's hard because we don't want to get into spoiler territory, but I really think you're putting too much of an emphasis on how this film wraps up. And of course, I can't say this for certainty, but I'd like to think that even if I didn't know Christopher Nolan had come out publicly and said, I have no intentions of making another Batman film, that this is going to close up my part of this franchise, that I would have still known that from watching this film.
Oh, I wouldn't have. I came out of this thinking, did he really say he wasn't going to do anymore?
I know what you're thinking, of course, because I've seen the film. I know what you're latching onto, but I still don't think that there's anything that's so telegraphed that it says we have to expect more movies. All the movie gives us at the end is hope. And whether or not a studio ever decides to go back and do it, I didn't get the sense that we're going to see more films. I honestly did not.
I'm glad you said hope, because for me, it takes what was a Shakespearean-level tragedy, which was an awesome approach for a superhero genre, and suddenly brought us around to this hope that felt a little franchise-serving, whereas The Dark Knight, and why I think it's the pinnacle of the series, was pure tragedy. But let's get to some of
I'm not going to begrudge a little bit of lightness amid all this darkness, finally, at the end of the film, Josh.
It's not a little bit of lightness. It brings us completely into the light.
Exactly.
Well, and I guess that's good.
We haven't had that this entire franchise.
And that was its distinctive mark. That was its mark as a franchise.
I don't think we lost that mark. No, I definitely don't think so. You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. We're arguing about The Dark Knight Rises.
Even though
we both really liked it.
Christopher
Nolan's franchise closer that does open this weekend. And I said that I think it does stand on its own. And I think that one of the ways it does stand out from not only other superhero movies, but from the franchise, as I recall it, is, for lack of a better word, it's realism. I don't need all of my superhero movies to feel gritty, but when somebody can pull it off, can ground a movie in a way that you can actually allow yourself to believe that there could be a guy in a cape and mask trying to save, let's say, New York City, and it could be the current world we live in, not an alternate universe, that's impressive. And for me, personally, more interesting than some of the other superhero movies, even the ones I've enjoyed. And at least it's an alternative, Josh, to the primary colored spectacles, and I mean that literally and figuratively, that we've seen so much of over the past decade or so. The Dark Knight, I'll admit, had a similar sense of realism about it. But I think here, not only has Nolan grounded it visually, the story does have an economic angle to it that couldn't seem more relevant when you consider our current financial situation, and we're regularly hearing shouts of class warfare on the news. Does the dystopic world, I think I can give this much away, that Nolan offers the second half of this film completely pay off in the end? No, I didn't completely buy it, but it definitely sets this film on firmer ground than I expected it to.
That was the best thing about it, this class warfare subtext. I absolutely love that, how it straddles that line between realism and this superhero comic book world so that it's just real enough to make us nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Part of Bane's plan, the villain played by Tom Hardy, is to turn the poor and disenfranchised of Gotham against the rich. So it's this tantalizing echo of the Occupy movement. You know, the Occupy movement just gone berserk.
Exactly.
And there are so many great little touches. I don't think it's too heavy-handed. It may end up getting criticized for playing that too much, but I appreciated how they did it in little touches. At one point, Bane invades a stock exchange.
Yeah.
And when he and his henchmen make their getaway, I love the touch that they strap as hostages the traders on the back of their motorcycles. So we have these elaborately dressed traders being driven through Gotham streets as hostages. That was just a great moment.
Yeah, and tying in with the economic theme, for me, the phrase I wrote down in my notes as this movie went on was upward mobility. if you think about economics, it makes sense, of course. And there is this recurring motif throughout the film of upward mobility. One character's ambition prevents him from focusing on the true bad guy. And I am being vague here, yes. Another major character gets a promotion at one point and is obviously glad to get that promotion. We hear talk of kids aging out of an orphanage. I love that idea that even the kids hit a ceiling that they can't go past. And lots of characters, not just our hero, get stuck literally below ground trying to get up to the light. So this whole economic idea of climbing that ladder, trying to get to that point where you feel like you've attained some kind of financial success and that defines you, that just dominates this film.
And it's echoed in one of the key characters, which is Anne Hathaway's Selina Kyle, who I don't think has ever called Catwoman, but that's essentially
good
who
point.
She's
yeah.
playing. She brings a lot of wit to this franchise, which it has kind of needed, so I like that. But I also liked how she ties into this theme of class warfare, because they present her as a thief out of necessity. I think they say something about how she was first in jail at 16,
mm-hmm.
and she has a couple of scenes where she explains why she does this and how she's at least stealing from the rich. She's got a little bit of a Robin Hood in her. So that really added a lot to that character. I thought that character worked. I know this is going to be a real flashpoint for people because Hathaway is in general for some reason, and maybe people won't buy her. I thought that was a really interesting character and it worked in the film.
You think this can last? There's a storm coming, Mr. Wayne. You and your friends better batten down the hatches. Because when it hits, you're all going to wonder how you ever thought you could live so large and leave so little.
I think Selina Kyle is an interesting character, and it did actually work for me. I'll be honest, as I did see previews for this on TV or times I was subjected to a trailer, because I'm with you, I definitely tried to avoid as much as I could, I would see her, and I like Anne Hathaway overall as an actress. I think she's more formidable than she gets credit for. That said, she seems so physically slight that something about her playing off Christian Bale and playing this badass Catwoman, I was really skeptical, and I was also skeptical about the fact that the Catwoman was in this film at all, because you can see how grounded and gritty and real it is, even in those clips that you've seen online or seen on TV, and something about the Catwoman just strikes me of that Tim Burton kind of theatricality.
Yeah,
that,
yeah.
Don't get me wrong, I liked in the first two Batman movies, but it just didn't seem like it was appropriate for this world. I gotta say, I'm in Anne Hathaway's corner. I think they pulled it off.
I think they did.
The character works. I think the performance works.
And they keep those realistic touches, I mean, within this world, so that she doesn't wear cat ears, but these glasses, these like sunglasses that she wears when she flips them up on the back of her head.
Right.
You know, they make little pointy ears. So I like that. And I think what Hathaway does, I mean, we get a lot of the butt-kicking female action stars, but she really taps into how her femininity is not just a weapon, it's also a disguise.
Right.
A lot of times she uses, and I like that because it's
yeah.
different from
There's a good acting moment.
There's a couple of them. The one I'm thinking of,
the
bar scene.
She has to play a girl. She has
yeah.
to play a hysterical girl,
yes.
and she really pulls it off.
In a second, she switches from that to Selina, you know, to her real personality. So I like that, and I think she was a good addition. Yeah, definitely.
Well, I think one of the other things that struck me about this film, and another way that this film is really grounded in the real, is how about the fact that the alternative title for this movie, I think, could have been Batman Grows Old. Because that's really mm-hmm. what we see. Regardless of what may or may not happen to Bruce Wayne at the end of this film, there is a sense, as you watch the film, that this Batman is certainly done. And there's something a little bit startling about that. If you think about our cinematic heroes, James Bond never ages. They just find a new one. Superman is always the same age. They just come back in different forms. They're eternally young, and we latch on to them. The Dark Knight Rises suggests, I think, that we may not outgrow our heroes, but maybe our heroes can actually outgrow us. And that's what happens with Bruce Wayne. And something about seeing him older, having a tough time moving, seeming like he is, as one character suggests at one point, he looks like he's 65 or 70.
And he has a cane
out
in
of
the
his
opening
car. He
scenes,
has a cane.
Yeah.
There's something that really is startling in a really fun, refreshing way about that.
Completely agree. That's what I loved about the beginning. But then let me ask you, do you feel that it carries through with that through the entire film?
Okay.
I guess that's where my problem was, is I really appreciated that. And I wanted to see that followed through. And the Bruce Wayne of the final moments of the film is much more of the conventional superhero.
I disagree.
Than the one you were just describing.
We just read the ending of the film differently, I guess. We're going to have to accept that. You're listening to Film Spotting. Hopefully you'll accept that you're listening to Josh Larson and Adam Kempinar talking about Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight Rises. I guess, even though I wanted to get off the ending, I do want to say this about it. There are a lot of action movies, a lot of superhero movies I can point to that have thrilled me, but I hate being this enthusiastic. I really do. There's something about just feeling this boyish almost as I say this, but I don't know how many films have excited me and also had quite the emotional kick that this film has at the end when this saga closes. I'm being honest. It almost got a little bit too dusty in the theater.
Wow.
At the end of this film. There's a moment that the film sets up. I didn't know it was setting it up. It did surprise me. But when it got there, it absolutely struck the right chord. It really hit me. And I guess to some extent, if it didn't hit you on that emotional gut level, then maybe the film didn't work for you, obviously, as well as it did for me. I want to say also, though, that one of the ways this film really stands out head and shoulders above Batman Begins is in the way the fight scenes are staged and choreographed. They are so much less chaotic, even, I think, than The Dark Knight. They're the most easy to follow, I think, we've seen from this franchise. And Nolan wisely just lets the brute force of Tom Hardy as Bane and Batman stand on its own. They have a showdown early in the film. They have a showdown later. And those are pretty stunning. And I love the way they're filmed in that you actually know what's going on from moment to moment. I really love that.
Some of those might be technique changes and decisions Nolan has done since the other films, but some of it is also out of narrative necessity. This is set up as a mano-a-mano duel between Batman and Bane. And I do like that because they had to go somewhere different than the Joker, which is this kind of wily, though, you know, he has physical moments too. He's mostly a conniver. So here we just have pure brute force in Bane. And that works. I mean, a lot of times in comic book movies, I've talked about how I like Loki in the Avengers because he's more of a schemer and not the usual big bad guy. Meddler. Thank you for reminding me. Yes. But here, I mean, if you're going to go for brute force, okay, then cast Tom Hardy and go for it. And they do. And what that adds to is the other thing you and I both appreciate about this is the frailty of Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they're fighting and you see Bane,
you know he's going to lose.
You know there's a chance it's going to go really bad. Not just for dramatic effect or for that, oh, this is going to be tough. You're really worried in this movie.
Yeah, you fear.
Batman's going to get it.
You fear for his life.
Yep.
There's absolutely truth to that. It actually brought me out to the point where I was thinking, why isn't Bruce Wayne smart enough to know that he's met his match?
I did think about that a couple times, but I think it ties into the character too, because there's something about stubbornness to him that they've played up throughout the franchise.
And being willing, perhaps, it certainly comes up many times in this film, this notion of having a little bit of a death wish.
I mean,
he might be willing to push himself to the breaking point. Absolutely.
Exactly.
So I think, though, as I've just gone on this love fest about The Dark Knight Rises, I have to mention my one huge reservation with this film. And I suppose that even though the score is overbearing and totally unmemorable in every way except for having a larger presence in the film than Batman himself, I can't really blame Hans Zimmer, the composer. I suppose I have to blame Christopher Nolan for the fact that this is a really good movie, despite the fact that the score is employed so heavy-handedly that it almost does single-handedly destroy the movie. It is omnipresent and obnoxious. It dominates the film in amount and volume, and it not only frequently makes the dialogue, for me, Josh, unintelligible. I lost a lot of lines, and not just Bane's lines through his mask. I lost a lot of dialogue here, but it reduces every potentially profound emotional moment to fluff. Somewhere in this world right now, I swear, Michael Caine just started a conversation and strings started swelling behind him. I think they're just following him now because it just is too much. And realistically, it's going to be a long, long time before I ever find the time to rewatch this movie. But if I do, or when I do, I swear I might just turn the volume down completely and turn the subtitles on.
I think it's more than a score problem. I think it's a structural problem. One of the ways I feel this is weaker than The Dark Knight is that it's not as cohesive or well-balanced. It's a good 20 minutes longer. The Dark Knight was already long, but it seemed to know what to do with that time. Here, we're jumping around a lot, jumbling a lot more, and the score gets lost in that or overused in that. In The Dark Knight, and also in Batman Begins, I love how Nolan, and he does this in his other films, the score will stretch across sequences. Now, maybe you feel that's wallpapering, but in general, what I find with Nolan
is that, and I generally do,
but in the other films, I find that it heightens this tension and provides a cohesiveness while we're going to a lot of
maybe
different places.
Maybe it was just more subtle, though.
Here, perhaps.
It's not.
But here, it seems like there's so much going on, and we're packing so much in that the score is kind of getting chopped up too and relied on too much. So I'd agree that that is one of the faults.
Well, I alluded to it earlier. I think you're right. There is a point, as much as I really did enjoy this film, and as much as it, in the end, justified for me its running time, there was a point where I started becoming aware of how long it was going on. And I think that's because of the structure. I think it's because Nolan and his brother, who wrote the screenplay, they bite off so much here. There is a point in this film, I'll be vague again as I've tried to be throughout this discussion, where things do turn into a bit of a dystopia. They've already taken so much time and care creating this world of Gotham City that we buy it as real, that then there's a switch where everything about that world changes. Everything about how that civilization, that society is structured, is called into question. It becomes almost a little bit like a Soylent Green, Children of Men type of environment. And the fact is, those movies take a lot of time to establish the reality of that world. It's almost as if you've got two separate films and we don't have time. We got to get to the end of the story. We don't have time to reestablish this new world. And so I think that there is something lacking in some of those scenes where it feels like swelling music, let's cut together some montages, let's get to the end of this film. And there are a lot of open questions kind of about how this world is really working that the movie wants us to sort of ignore and get past. And that is something I was definitely aware of as the film went on. But I think for me, that maybe be my only criticism other than the score. Really, really, maybe the worst experience I've ever had with music ruining
wow.
a film.
So we're not going to be hearing any of the score over this show, huh? You don't even want to hear it again.
I don't know if I can hear Hans Zimmer ever,
wow.
ever again after this film. What about some closing random thoughts? I'm sure you have a few random notes that stuck out to you as this film.
Yeah, I don't want to do any more complaining, so I'll stick to the things I like. And we talked about Bane just as this brute force, but I think Hardy does give a good performance, too. He's stuck behind the mask, obviously, so he can't use his face as a tool.
Mm-hmm.
I love how he uses his body movements then, especially the way he kind of saunters with power, but also this lightness. It reminded me a lot of his performance in Bronson, actually, where he's another kind of lethal
heavy
force.
But you're right. There's something almost
athletic and
he's like a tiger.
Yeah. And you know, there's going to be comparisons between Ledger as the Joker and Hardy here as Bane. You know, Ledger just created an all-time character. So I don't think that's fair. But what I do like is that they've gone such different directions with these characters that Bane can stand on his own and functions perfectly for this film, except towards that ending, which we'll have to get in at some point on bonus content.
We're
going
to have to save that for bonus spoiler talk, because that's one of the areas where obviously not only the ending of the film as a whole worked for me, but where they take Bane's character really worked for
me.
Yes, it did. Oh. And I'll just say it's largely because of the fact that it does further differentiate him from the Joker, which up to that point, I think he's a lot like the Joker. So, yeah, actually that did work. For me, the only two things I want to throw in, I saw the credit and there was this face. He's kind of one of the slimy bad guys who is working against Bruce Wayne and working with Bane early in the film. And he's played by Ben Mendelsohn. And right away when I saw the name, I remembered Animal Kingdom, the Australian film from a couple of years ago that we really liked. He's the psycho in that film. And here he's not so much a psycho. He's just slimy and a bad guy. But that actor, Ben Mendelsohn, is very good at playing someone just a little bit off his rocker. There's something, I was thinking about it, just a little bit dead behind the eyes of that guy. He's a scary presence on screen, even though he's not in any way at all here intimidating. I really like him. My other question to close, it's the most important thing we've talked about so far, Josh, without a doubt. I want to know why Batman still talks with the growl, even when he's only talking to people who know he's Bruce Wayne.
That's a good question.
Why doesn't he stop growling? Is he just so used to it he can't stop himself? Why doesn't he just go to Bruce Wayne voice?
I think it's something with the mask. It's just once you put it on, you have to talk that way.
You have to, like, it clicks in his head, or there's some kind of device.
A device.
You think so?
Yeah. There is a bat device.
Oh, I had to close.
A bat growler.
This was such a smart discussion. I thought we were having a really good one, and now we're just going to get a flood of emails from people telling us about how the bat suit really works.
Yes.
And,
well, I'm so curious. I'd love to know.
Exactly. Well, I guess that's a good stopping point here. Obviously, The Dark Knight Rises. Josh, you're a fan. I'm a bigger fan. It's out now in theaters, probably everywhere, literally everywhere that you're listening to this podcast or this radio show.
It might be playing in your home.
Yeah, you are in a position to see this film. Of course, we expect many of you to see it. We want to know what you thought of it. what we got right, what we got wrong. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, or you can leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
How many critics does it take to grapple with Beasts of the Southern Wild? At least four, as Adam and I are joined by Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune and A.O. Scott of the New York Times. Stay with us.
Once again, the great sponsor Audible.com is on board for another week of Film Spotting. They're the internet's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment, providing digital versions of tens of thousands of audiobooks for download to your computer, iPhone, Android phone, BlackBerry, and iPod.
You can listen whenever and wherever you want, just like the podcast you are listening to right now. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from. Every genre, Audible has it covered.
And every week when we do an Audible recommendation here in the show, we like to feature a pick from a Film Spotting listener, a pick or two from various Film Spotting listeners. And we got this great one from Richard Klein, who posted it over at facebook.com/filmspotting. He writes, "I've been a member of Audible for almost 10 years and have accumulated a sizable library of books that range from classics like Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children to popular mysteries, many of them subsequently made into films like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, or already were made into films like Lolita. Of course, a great listening experience requires a great narrator, and sometimes even the best of stories is marred by an uninteresting reader. Here are four I heartily recommend: The Fortress of Solitude by Jonathan Lethem and read by David Aaron Baker, The Custom of the Country by Edith Wharton and read by Lorna Raver, Life of Pi by Yann Martell and read by Jeff Woodman, and lastly, in that great Film Spotting tradition, A Cheat, The Talisman and Black House, both by Stephen King and Peter Straub, read by Frank Mueller."
Together, Richard continues, "This is 54 hours of such excitement, you might be tempted to drive across the whole country just to keep listening to it. The multiple Audi winner, Mr. Mueller, was one of Stephen King's favorite narrators, but tragically, he died in a car accident in 2008.
I did look that up. The Audi, if you will, is an actual award. Every year they do give out awards for excellence in audiobooks, and obviously Mr. Mueller is one of the best if he's received multiple awards. So thank you very much, Richard, for those great recommendations. We will list those titles, if they went by too fast, in the show notes at filmspotting.net. Just click on 406. You'll see them there in the notes. And if you do have a recommendation for us, we want to feature it. Tell us which audiobooks you really have enjoyed listening to over the years. Maybe even recently you've checked one out, maybe for the first time. Email feedback@filmspotting.net or go over to facebook.com/filmspotting and post your pick on the wall.
For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting. That's audiblepodcast.com/filmspotting.
My name is David Siegel.
My name is Jacqueline Siegel.
I am the founder, CEO of the largest timeshare company in the world.
I'm a 43-year-old mother of eight.
I thought she was the most beautiful girl in the world.
It took me a while to fall in love with him.
We have a great relationship.
There's 30 years between us, but he doesn't need Viagra. At least there is that option if he does. Like, I don't know if 10 years from now.
We never sought out to build the biggest house in America. It just kind of happened.
It's bigger than the White House.
2 tennis courts.
30 bathrooms.
Full-size baseball field.
10 kitchens.
Antique furniture.
90,000 square feet.
Oh, my God.
No, that's not my room. That's my closet.
No way.
Nothing's really normal about this life.
We're in line to do $1 billion in sales for the year. We're on top of the world. And it came to a screeching halt.
The market fell over 700 points.
I would say it's touch and go right now.
We don't talk about financial problems. I guess I'll have to watch the movie to find out what's going on in my life.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that's a clip from the trailer for the new documentary, The Queen of Versailles. It's a film about a billionaire family and the challenges they face financially going through these tough economic times. I've heard really good things about it, but haven't had a chance to see it yet myself. And we're very excited, Josh, to announce that we've got 50 Admit 2 passes to give away, free passes to an upcoming screening of The Queen of Versailles, Monday, July 30th, 7:30 p.m. at the Landmark Theater here in Chicago. So for all our local listeners, if you're curious about this film, you want to see it in advance of its release and see it for free, you can do that. Just go to filmspotting.net and you can get the details there in the top story. But really, all you got to do is email us feedback@filmspotting.net with the title of the film, The Queen of Versailles, in the subject line, and you'll be entered to win. Let's get to Massacre Theater now. This is where we perform a scene from a screenplay and you get a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Brandy, rope, axe.
We found these.
Good, good. Well, it's 17 minutes and he ain't back.
16 minutes.
Well, let's go.
Mr. Rogo, can't we wait just a few
what
minutes?
What for? I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to move that way and fast. Now, let's go.
Mr. Rogo! Mr. Rogo!
What's the matter? What happened? Where you been?
With Mr. Scott. We found a hatch. He thought it might lead to the engine room, but he wasn't sure. So he told me if he wasn't back in 5 minutes, to tell you to do it your way.
Come on, kid. Pull yourself.
God damn it, that does it! We've been wasting time sitting here while we should have been up front with those other people. Now, come on, let's go.
That's Pamela Sue Martin, a very young Pamela Sue Martin. I know, Josh, you were a big Dynasty watcher, so you're very familiar with her body of work, right?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, loved her.
And Ernest Borgnine from 1972's The Poseidon Adventure, directed by Ronald Neame. Though, if you look on IMDb, and I had some fun with IMDb in this film because I'm not too familiar with The Poseidon Adventure as I was preparing for this show, Irwin Allen, the director, actually was uncredited as directing the action scenes.
Did not know that.
From The Poseidon Adventure. And Ronald Neame is a name I didn't know at all. I wanted to see what else he had done. Turns out he is a British filmmaker who did the 1970 version of Scrooge with Albert Finney. So he's well known for that. He also did The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, another very well-known film. So that's your IMDb tip for the week.
Thanks for all your extra effort there, Adam.
From here on Film Spotting, it took a lot to go look that up at imdb.com. The screenplay by Sterling Siliphant and Wendell Mays. And to give you one other quick note, Sterling Siliphant, always will be a hero of mine, wrote a great film from 1968, In the Heat of the Night. So
Another
little tidbit for you. The tie-in, of course, comes to us from Adam in San Clemente, California.
My guess is The Poseidon Adventure, and my reason for the guess is the recent passing of Ernest Borgnine. And if that is the case, and I was in charge, I would have gone with a scene from Escape from New York. But I'm not in charge and might not even be right. Keep up the great work and not so great acting.
You are right, but you're not in charge. And the fact is, we've already done Escape from New York. That's why we couldn't do it. It was our first choice.
And see, you knew that, so that's why you're in charge.
Exactly. Actually, I just did another search on our website for Escape from New York, and yep, sure enough, we have done it. We actually did it fairly recently, I think. Unfortunately, that was ruled out, so we went with The Poseidon Adventure instead. But yes, we definitely wanted to pay a little bit of tribute to Ernest Borgnine, who passed recently. And some listeners cynically had to point out that there was another connection to last week's show, Josh, which was a review of The Amazing Spider-Man. They said basically it's another film that had a remake or a reboot that was completely unnecessary. I think there was a 2005 like TV version.
Yeah, I was going to say something on TV, I think.
That's not where we were going. We were, in fact, trying to pay tribute to Ernest Borgnine. And we got this great note about Ernest Borgnine from Jeff Scheinkoff in Brooklyn, New York.
I got to see Ernest last year in the Chicago area when he and a few other original cast members presented a screening of Poseidon on the big screen. I'm a little too young to have seen it in the theater originally, so it was a real treat. But the highlight was hearing him tell some entertaining stories and generally act about 50 years younger than the 94 he was at the time. He probably did personal appearances like that all the time, yet he still made it seem like he was having the best time in the world. He was funny, full of energy, and as much of a character in person as he was on screen. We lost a real treasure.
Thanks for that note, Jeff. That really is something about Ernest Borgnine that came through. Whenever I'd see him, whether it be early on in the Oscar telecast when he'd show up on the red carpet or any appearance I ever caught on TV or radio, he always seemed like he was about 50 years younger than he really was. 94, that's hard to believe.
And that personality also makes his appearance in From Here to Eternity, which we also consider pretty interesting because he's this big bruising bully in that film.
Right, which he could play that part because he was a big man, but at the same time, he seemed like such a teddy bear. So why don't you go ahead and reach into the film spotting hat? It's really not brimming at all. Apparently, not many fans of the original Poseidon Adventure out there in our film snob audience, Josh. So pick out this week's winner.
The winner's Bruce Cantwell from Portland, Oregon.
Congratulations, Bruce. He has been entering Massacre Theater, I think, since at least 2006.
Wow.
And almost
weekly.
It
took this long?
So he is due for a win.
I'd say so.
Congratulations, Bruce. Email feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your prize.
I've worked with a lot of directors, Lloyd. Some of them were geniuses, some of them were bastards, but I've never met one who was so totally and absolutely, I don't know.
Thank you, Gary. I'm very touched. Now, will you get up the stage?
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, the premier location to discover, explore, and share great independent, foreign, and classic cinema. Film Spotting listeners receive the first 30 days free.
Support Film Spotting and sign up now at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Fandor, essential films instantly.
This week's Massacre Theater winner will get a complimentary 6-month subscription to Fandor. This is such a great scene, as usual. I know we're not going to do it justice.
Oh, I feel really bad about what we're going to do to this scene because it's so good.
We are going to crush this scene in a very bad way. But we'll give you this hint. It does tie in with our top 5 this week.
Yes.
Stormy weather movies. I'm going to start it off. So, Josh, you're going to give me the action.
All right. You ready to do this?
No.
Then we're ready. And action.
I haven't been on a date since I was married, and that was 3 years ago. And whatever you want to tell me, whatever you think might scare me, won't. And I will listen to you. I will be a good listener to you if that's what you want. You know, I won't judge you. I know I can do that sometimes, and I won't. I can listen. And I mean, you shouldn't be scared of scaring me off or whatever you think I think and on. You should just say it, whatever it is, and I'll listen to you.
You don't know how stupid I am.
It's okay.
You don't know how crazy I am.
It's okay.
I've got troubles, okay?
I'll take everything at face value. I'll be a good listener to you.
Oh, I started this, didn't I?
Say what you want, and you'll see.
Wanna kiss me?
Yes, I do.
And scene.
What was that, Josh?
That's a clue to one of the movies we reviewed this week. You didn't get it?
You didn't hold your hands over your face, though.
No, not that guy. The other guy.
The other guy. Oh, your Batman growl. Very well done. Very well done. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, July 24th.
Sorry to trip you up on that. I thought it was much more accurate.
I was really into this emotional moment. And
Batman's emotional. The winner will be selected randomly for all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Excuse me. Have you ever danced with the devil in the pale moonlight?
I'm gonna kill you.
You idiot! You made me, remember? You dropped me into that vat of chemicals. That wasn't easy to get over. Don't think that I didn't try.
You killed my parents.
What?
Huh.
What are you talking about?
I made you. You made me first.
Hey, bad brain. I mean, I was a kid when I killed your parents. I mean, I say I made you. You gotta say you made me. And how childish can you get, huh? You wouldn't hit a guy with glasses on, would you? Huh?
Well, speaking of Batman, and as we discuss The Dark Knight Rises, we get to that scene from the original, not the Adam West Batman, but the original film, if you will, Tim Burton from the 80s with Michael Keaton. And we posed to you last week at filmspotting.net our weekly poll question, anticipating our discussion this week. We wanted to know which of the two first films in the Batman franchises you appreciated more. It's a Batman deathmatch. Your two options were simply Burton's Batman or Nolan's Batman Begins. Josh, maybe not a surprise. The majority of Film Spotting going against our picks.
I know. And this, I don't know if it's a generational thing.
I think it's a generational thing.
I thought this would have been closer, actually. I'm not surprised that Batman Begins wins, which it did with 68%. But Burton's Batman only got 32%. That surprises me.
Yeah, it surprised me too. I thought it would be a little bit closer, maybe 60-40, but almost 70-30 was a pretty big divide. And I do. I think maybe just if you consider our listening population, there's a fair number of people that maybe don't really remember Burton's Batman, or certainly they look very favorably on Nolan's films. And
I wonder if it's a question of what you've seen first, too, because I could see if you've seen Batman Begins first, then you go back to Burton's, which is much more, I don't want to say cartoonish, but circus-like, maybe, is the term. I could see how you might be thrown off, like, what is this? It's almost a joke, really.
I could see that as well. We certainly got some responses in the poll and a couple email responses from listeners saying, come on, I can't believe that Nolan's film is just destroying Burton's Batman. But we do thank everyone who voted in the poll. This week's question over at filmspotting.net, I think, is appropriate not only with the Batman subject matter, but of course, it's in the news. A lot of people, if you follow other film people on Twitter, you may be aware that Comic-Con happened last week in San Diego. It seemed to be all anybody in the film community was talking about. And there were a number of really interesting panels there for different films, some different TV shows that they have, some big events geared around specific shows and movies. And so we put together this list. We were curious, if you were at Comic-Con and you can only attend one of these non-Django Unchained related events, because there was a Tarantino Django Unchained panel, and Tarantino just seems to run away with most poll questions.
Had to take that out of there.
So we just took it out. You can only attend one of these events. Which one do you choose?
Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim panel, the Firefly reunion, Neil Blomkamp's Elysium panel, or Ryan Johnson's Looper panel, or perhaps I would never attend Comic-Con.
Okay, Josh, I'm really curious. You actually admitted to me that Django Unchained would not have been your first choice. It would be another one of these options. So which one is it?
I think Del Toro's Pacific Rim panel.
That really?
Whatever he's up to is going to be interesting to me, and this one seems a little bit of a departure from stuff he's done, so I'd like to hear about that.
Well, of course, I'd be very curious to hear about Ryan Johnson's Looper. Ryan, a friend of the show, very excited about that movie. But maybe because I've already talked to him enough, I would skip that one. And I would actually go to the Firefly reunion panel.
Would you?
I would.
Big Firefly fan.
I really like Serenity. And I have to admit that I've never finished the entire Firefly set. I know there weren't a ton of episodes, a season and a half or maybe two seasons. But it's something I know I'll finish at some point. Love Malcolm Reynolds. Love Nathan Fillion in that lead role. And I am a fan of that series. So, yeah, I'd want to see the Firefly reunion panel. We want to know what you think, even though realistically, Josh, I'll probably never attend Comic-Con. It's just
It in your future?
Well, it may happen. I'm not ruling it out. I don't have anything against it.
You know, I don't know if I'm going to be able to go on with the show, though. That Batman voice, it's tore me up.
Wow.
I don't know how Christian Bale
does
it.
Top 5 is going to be all messed up.
This is going to be hard.
Well, we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
And it all goes quiet behind my eyes. I see everything that made me. Flying around in invisible pieces. I see that I'm a little piece of a big, big universe.
You're gonna be the king of the bad time. I promise that.
In a million years, when kids go to school, they gotta know. Once there was a hush puppy, and she lived with her daddy in the bathtub.
This is Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And that was the trailer for Ben Zeitlin's Beasts of the Southern Wild, winner of the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance and the Camera d'Or for Best First Film at Cannes. Beasts has, since opening in New York and L.A. on June 27th, emerged as arguably the most divisive film of the year. On one side of the bayou are critics hailing it an inventive, impressive American debut, a work of, quote, creative genius, according to Roger Ebert. On the other side are critics decrying its slick and perhaps even exploitative pretensions. In response to Michael Phillips' negative review in the Chicago Tribune a few weeks ago, A.O. Scott unleashed this tweet directed at his former At the Movies partner. Where are the cameras? I want to tape a show with Phillips Tribune now. It would be one hell of a fight. This bout, alas, is not televised, but the two heavyweights accepted our offer to come on for a beast battle. Here with us in Chicago is regular film spotting contributor and guest host, Michael Phillips. Michael, thanks for coming on.
All right. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here, Adam.
Fantastic. And joining us by phone from New York, he and Manola Dargis are the chief film critics for the New York Times. A.O. Scott, Tony, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's great to be here. It's wonderful to, you know, to demand satisfaction and then get it.
There you go. It really is a thrill to be able to reunite you two as well. Since you're the newcomer to the show, Tony, we'll start with you.
Okay.
Beasts of the Southern Wild is the story of a six-year-old girl named Hush Puppy living and struggling to survive post-Katrina with her sick father in an isolated patch of New Orleans Delta dubbed the Bathtub. It's a visually eclectic bit of magically realist Americana that I can most easily sum up as Terrence Malick meets Maurice Sendak. And I love the close to your Times review, Tony. You wrote, "Discovering this movie is like stumbling into a bar and encountering a band you've never heard of playing a kind of music that you can't quite identify. Nor can you figure out how the musicians learn to play the way they do with such fire and mastery. Did they pick it up from their grandparents, study at a conservatory, watch instructional videos on the internet, or just somehow make it all up? Are you witnessing the blossoming of authenticity or the triumph of artifice?" Explain your answer to that question and make your case for the film.
Well, I think that this movie works on a kind of wonderfully visceral and emotional level, if it works for you, and it certainly worked for me. That is, a lot of critics, I think, both pro and con, have kind of picked at the authenticity or the genuineness of it, and you know, who are the filmmakers and what is their relationship to the world that they're depicting, the characters and the non-professional actors they're using. And I think that this is, like a lot of great works of American imagination, a hybrid. It's an intellectual construct, and it's also an explosion of feeling. It's the discovery of a new world that's partly a real world and partly an imaginary world. And the thing, all of the elements of it, the neo-realist elements, the magic realist elements, the music, the monsters, the kind of somewhat chaotic mise-en-scene, you know, all of the sort of rushing handheld camera work and these kind of beautiful mythical set pieces, all for me just work together in into something that just felt very new and fresh and wonderful. It just moved me in a way, transported me in a way that very few films recently, and certainly not, I think, not many first features from young American directors have in the last few years. I just felt like there was this drive that Ben Zeitlin and his co-screenwriter, Lucy Alibar, felt to go out maybe of themselves and their immediate circle and their, you know, immediate personal concerns and discover something or invent something out there in the world.
Now, Michael, in total honesty here, your two-star review was certainly not as vitriolic as some others, but we need you to be the villain here on the show. So what's your case against Beasts of the Southern Wild?
Not my case against it is every time I hear the film described, as Tony just did, it's a film I dearly would have loved to have seen, and I can see how others experience that way, because it is, and it is not in any way a sloppy or ill-considered film, but it's a rush of feeling. It is much more about a swirl of visceral emotion than, you know, any kind of neat narrative track. It's not after that kind of thing. I also don't understand the people that write it off completely on a political level, which I know Tony and I have heard a lot about and other people have read about all over, you know, from Twitter on up, in that they find it kind of a reactionary or, you know, kind of a libertarian dream of, you know, this community that just wants the government off its back. And, you know, to me, that's nonsense, because it's a portrait of a isolated community in crisis that really isn't about politics of any kind. Where I just couldn't get on board was, to me, that wash of feeling, that rush of sort of that swirling handheld sort of I hate to use this phrase, but documentary style imagery. To me, it just became dramatically monotonous, and I thought the film had absolutely no kind of peaks and valleys to it. So it was almost kind of a mechanical resistance to it, of just like, give these characters we're trying to get to know a little breathing room. You know, I do find that young actress terrific, but I think all the deserved attention on the young actress who was 5 when she was cast and 6 when it was filmed, is taking the attention away and the heat off a big hole in the film for me, which was Dwight Henry as Wink, and you know, a non-actor, admittedly, but you know, I think he could have been told to just find a different way to read a line instead of just yelling and screaming everything. And a lot of that's a little bit of a fault in the writing, in that it's a haranguing kind of role. And I found the film visually a bit of a harangue, frankly, and I just couldn't get close enough on one hand, and I couldn't get enough distance from it in another. And I don't like the way he scores his film either. And he's a co-composer, Ben Zeidlin. He's a very talented guy and admittedly talented filmmaker, very impressive first feature. But I hate the way he overscores this picture and kind of has his fingers around the throat of the film with the score, cueing you every single moment on what kind of emotion to feel.
If the music isn't working for you, that's definitely going to be a problem, because it is a near constant presence in the film Beasts of the Southern Wild. It's Film Spotting. That was guest Michael Phillips with his case against the new film Beasts of the Southern Wild. A.O. Scott from the New York Times is joining us by phone. Tony, your rebuttal to Michael?
Well, I think that he actually makes a good case, and in a way our argument does come down to a sort of a subjective one, which is that, you know, either this works for you. I mean, either you are, because the movie is trying to push your emotional buttons and to sweep you up into a state of emotion. So it kind of stands or falls, I think, for each viewer on whether that happens. And, you know, it happens or it doesn't. It certainly happened with me. I thought right from the beginning I felt it just a kind of thrill, and also that I was sort of in the imaginative world of some of the American literature that I love. You know, I felt like this was in touch with Huckleberry Finn, you know, and Walt Whitman, and To Kill a Mockingbird, and the sort of the child as the perceiving consciousness and moral agent, which is just such a great theme in American literature. I felt like they were figuring out a way to honor this and to expand it and to update it. So I was, you know, I may have been an easy target for this movie, because it's the kind of story that I'm sort of a sucker for. But it definitely, I think, formally as well as thematically, just sort of worked for me.
Tony, I'm not sure you're making a very good case for the strengths of the movie by even talking about the writing at all, because if the adaptation of this screenplay is adapted very loosely from a play called Juicy
right.
and Delicious, and essentially what Zeitlin's done is throw out the play. There's very little dialogue. He's dealing with non-actors, and this is the decision he made, and it's mostly Days of Heaven style. It's voiceover in
yeah.
this young preteen's voice.
Yeah.
I think the writing is just pedestrian at best. If Zeitlin's got talent, and he certainly does, it's almost purely visual, and I don't know how much textual at all, so I don't know about Huck Finn, man.
Well, no, I'm just saying that this seems to me to belong in the same imaginative universe as those literary classics. It's not a movie that stands or falls by its writing, meaning the sort of the words that are spoken, but I think that there is a poetic and, in a way, I think a self-conscious literary imagination at work here.
Well, Josh, you've waited patiently to get a word in, but anyone who heard our top five films of 2012 so far knows that you're in the bag for this film. You had it at number one.
I did, and I don't like this talk about how it seems to be it manipulates someone and that's why it works for you. I don't think that's fair to the movie. This is not just an emotional exercise. There is a lot of technique and craft at work here that is doing something on a level beyond just an emotional response. Now, at the same time, Michael, you said, I dearly would have loved to have seen this movie that everyone's excited about. I would have loved for you to have seen that movie too, because when I hear people who have not appreciated it, I don't begrudge them that. It does have this sort of instinctual response that you have to it, but I do feel sorry for them, because this is such...
You pity me?
I pity you for not liking
me.
Beasts of the Southern Wild. This is such an experience. It's so much audacious creativity going on here. How often can we say, I've never seen anything like that? And that happens with this film. When we're watching movies that so often do the same things over and over, here is something that, even though it has its faults, and the Dwight Henry performance, I'll admit, does have some scenes where he needs to be pulled back, but I put him on my list of top five performances so far because he also has these scenes that are just powerhouse. He's loud, he's screaming. That's right, because the guy's in a panic. That's what I loved about this portrayal, is they weren't afraid to have this father who's in a panic, because the daughter is his responsibility, and he knows he can't do it. he's not up to it in this really apocalyptic situation. So I did like that performance. There were so many things going on here. I think political readings are incorrect. I would agree with that. But I really liked how it did have those tendrils going out to the real world. So we not only get Katrina, but you have references to the BP oil spill, the melting polar ice caps. It's not that it's making a statement about any of those things, but it's tapping into this general anxiety and unease in the real world where this is all going on and connecting to this magical fairy tale type place.
The one thing I would say, though, is that there's something about the cumulative effect of the way he shoots and edits and scores this, you know, very kind of handmade, homegrown, earnest film that reminds me of a BP oil spill cleanup commercial. I mean, it's got that sort of, it's got something, and this, I guess, links me to the other people who say there's something slightly dubious about the technique of the film. It just links it to a kind of a...
What are the moments, though, that, is it the parading prehistoric creatures that a BP commercial
No.
I mean, there's so much originality. What are the moments that remind you of a BP commercial? Something that would be slick and familiar and manipulative.
I think sometimes the celebration of a community, under fire, isolated, survivalists to the core, good American virtues and values and all that. It all seems a little
all scored to music.
All scored heavily to music, and there's a ton of filmmaking assurance behind every decision. And I just somehow it never felt spontaneous and of the moment to me. It felt a little too fussed over. And just frankly, dramatically monotonous. I guess that's my issue with it. And I wish, I'll give it another look someday, and just to see exactly.
You want to be as happy as we are. That's what you want to enjoy it as much.
I question if Josh deep down is really happy. So.
It's also very sad. I mean, it is a movie about facing devastating catastrophe and the loss of home. I mean, a girl who's lost, whose mother has. Vanished, whose father is dying, whose entire world that she's known is being swept away, and she's asserting a kind of defiance in the face of this. And I think the problem with the political readings of it is that they don't give enough credence to the kind of primal force of that defiance, and also the extent to which it's a kind of wishful thinking. This is a movie about how a child sees the world. A child is going to magically rediscover her mother, who's going to serve her fried alligator. A child is going to imagine she can face down the monsters. A child is going to imagine that, 1,000 years from now, everyone is going to know who she was. And there's something really both stirring and heartbreaking about that perception of the world. And one thing that I do like about this movie, to circle back to the politics, I don't think it's a disengaged or apolitical movie. One of the things that I really like about it is that it kind of generously opens itself to both a left-wing and a right-wing reading. You can read it as a sort of parable of don't tread on me individualism, and you can also read it as a parable of multicultural community.
It's the one thing it has in common with The Dark Knight Rises. It's politically very slippery.
Well, after the unbridled enthusiasm there of Josh and Tony and Michael's cynicism, I'll try to split this right down the middle a little bit. Certainly, if I'm going to give a pass to Sarah Polley for some of the bold choices she made in the mostly absurd Take This Waltz, which I did do recently here on the show, I've got to admire what Ben Zeitlin's doing artistically here. Josh, you're right. It is audacious, and I respect that. And Terrence Malick is an easy reference to make, but you can't help it. Michael, as you said, with Days of Heaven, the voiceover instantly recalls that film. But even more for me, it made me think of the sweet naivete of Sissy Spacek in Badlands. And the same qualities that really grabbed me with The Tree of Life are what grabbed me here. This movie is shot on Super 16mm, and the camera is constantly roaming. It's seeking new information. It's kind of like when you watch old home movies, and the person running the camera has no idea where the action is going and just follows it. I really like that. I love the nerve that Malick has as well of putting this young girl and putting this family and this community's plight in this larger cosmological context. That works for me. Separating it from Malick a little bit, at least The Tree of Life, I really like how Zeitlin explores the idea of this young girl creating a narrative for herself to cope with all these radical changes in her life. And so she's already got kind of, if you think about it, a fairy tale existence out in this forest, albeit one of abject poverty. And then Zeitlin lays over that this other fairy tale where she tries to make sense of her life and let the world know she's part of it. Let the world know that she's been here. And so for me, I'm with Tony that it was moving at times, sometimes profoundly so, like when the fairy tale and the reality at the end of the film finally come together and collide. That really worked for me. And I haven't mentioned yet the other big thing that worked for me. It is that lead performance of Quvenzhané Wallace. I feel like I have to watch this movie four or five more times to even really adequately try to sum up what she's doing. I don't really know how to describe what she's doing.
She's wonderful in it. And the one thing I would say that Zeilin had a great instinct for with this, his first feature, is exactly how much, quote, acting to get out of a six-year-old.
Right.
Just like the Dardenne brothers with the kid with the bike, mm-hmm. which is certainly one of the best films I've seen in the last year. I think the young, who was 11 or 12 at the time, maybe 13, Tomas Doré plays the young, very troubled young boy in that. And that similarly, you have there's a quality of authenticity in that work that works for you, whether or not the film does. And I guess I just find that Zeitlin's, it's a hammering technique of a crisis-laden situation. And I just felt like I needed a little more breathing room in there to fully experience and get close to characters mm-hmm. that are more than just emblems of a crisis or something.
Well,
and that's how I felt. I don't know. I'm not looking for an entirely different style. It's not like, there was a film, another hit out of Sundance a couple of years ago called Ballast, Lance Hammer made, a film I liked very much. Now, that film is in this placid, serene, very quiet style. It wouldn't make any damn sense at all for this story. So it's not like I'm looking for an entirely different attack. I'm just looking for less of an attack.
Well, I mean,
it was one of the things that I really liked about it was it was taking some of the kind of socially conscious regional realism that's been a hallmark and some would say a limitation of American independent film, especially of the Sundance variety for the past decade or so, and kind of shaking that up and breaking the mold a little bit by introducing these elements of fantasy, by being sort of boldly emotional, not kind of whispering at you and sort of inviting you to guess at the psychological state of the characters, but just sort of announcing its vision and sort of putting it all out there in its sloppy glory.
Hmm.
I just found it tremendously exciting. I mean, I've seen it a few times and brought my family and just every time walk out with my heart full. And, you know, sometimes even when you're a critic, you have to go with that.
Well, I responded similarly, as I said, at times, but I think where I do agree with you, Michael, a little bit is that as the film goes on and after the storm and we spend more time with them really trying to survive, where I think the film steers wrong a little bit is it starts to go into, for me, Gone Baby Gone territory. I'm thinking of the Ben Affleck film where he's shooting a film in, you know, working class, really kind of rough part of Boston. And similarly with that film here, it's like Zeitlin works so hard to be genuine and gritty and reflect this kind of insider's perspective on what life must be like, what life is like for these people in this place. I actually feel like it kind of goes the other way. It goes so far to such an extreme that he starts to seem like a bit of an outsider. There is a little bit of a tourist element that emerges, I think, as this movie goes on, where his camera just seems to be drawn to the most grotesque and the most absurd the deeper he goes into it.
It could be, although I think we may be mischaracterizing Zeitlin's relationship to the place he's filming, because I believe, Tony, isn't this right? He's lived down around New Orleans for several years.
Right.
He's part of a collective of filmmakers, some of whom are like he is from New York, but who have been down there for a long time. I don't think that's ever a good yardstick to measure sincerity or authenticity or artistic accomplishment, you know, what someone's personal connection to a place is. But I think that there is a knowledge of place and a sense of place in this movie. I don't think this is, just sort of people kind of blundering into
Yeah, I mean, Elia Kazan didn't know much about the Tennessee Valley Authority when he made Wild River, I don't think, and that's a film.
I think maybe what I was suggesting with the Affleck connection is, you know, of course, he is from Boston, whether he's from that part or not, and there's almost a sense of, as a director, trying to establish, I know this place really well, and I'm going to show you the deepest, darkest recesses of it. And I think actually there can be a point where you go too far with that. I see that here a little bit.
Here's what I think the most interesting thing I can say about Beasts of the Southern Wild is that it does make me very curious about where he's going to go with his second feature. I was cool to it, but that in and of itself is a good indication that he's got genuine talent. And he may develop in a way that, you know, I continue to resist, and so, just because it's kind of a full frontal attack on material that I think should breathe a little more. It is simply too early to say he's got one style and he's going to stick to it, right or wrong. It's although this film is very, very, very close to his earlier short film, Glory at Sea, right from the overture, the prologue on down.
Right.
But I'm not sure, frankly, he had enough story to tell in the story length he chose. But, you know, Josh, you were going to say something.
Yeah, let's close out with you, Josh.
Adam was just mentioning that towards the end it seems to go towards some more grotesque areas or scenes, but I actually felt the entire thing had this constant tension. Tony, I think the phrase you used was sloppy glory, which I loved, because there's this constant tension between filth and beauty throughout the movie that I think Zeitlin does a really good job of balancing. So we see things that are beautiful juxtaposed with something that's ugly, and it kind of asks us whether the beauty's being undercut by this ugliness, or is it encouraging us to always be open to the sublime, even within the ugly? And I really love that tension about it. This isn't a movie of uplift by any means, even though you can come out of it with your heart being full, as Tony said. I feel that way too, but it's not because it comes to this sort of triumphant ending. It's just this continual recognition of beauty within a really impoverished community that I appreciated as well.
Well, Beasts of the Southern Wild is out now, playing in select cities. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting. Michael, Tony, this was an absolute blast. Hopefully we can convince you to come on again sometime.
That'd be a pleasure. This was great.
I don't want to do it with Tony. You know.
Okay. Well, we'll talk about that.
You can't work under these conditions.
It's a stipulation. I love it. Again, thank you very much.
See you, Tom.
Thanks.
There's a storm coming like nothing you've ever seen.
Are Adam and I prepared for it? The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Every week here on Film Spotting, we like to take a moment to recognize our very generous supporters, the Film Spotting listeners who feel like the show is worthy of some of their hard-earned cash. As always, this little segment is brought to you by our partner, Jeff Goldsmith, over at the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. Features his interviews with screenwriters, and this week he's live from Comic-Con. He's bringing you interviews with the creators behind Workaholics, including actor-writers Blake Anderson, Adam Devine, Anders Holm, and writer-director Kyle Newacek. Of course, Jeff has also recently launched his new iPad magazine, Backstory, which features full-length screenplays, stage plays, interviews, and short films. Issue 01 is out now. It's free to the world. So if you have an iPad app, go to iTunes, do a search, and download it now. Let's go ahead and get to donations then, Josh. And we start with a very, very generous gold-level donor.
Marshall Tolee from Victoria, British Columbia says, I drive a long way to get to work, and I really look forward to my commutes to listen to the latest episode or catch up with the archives. I also want to say a huge thank you to Nate for introducing me to the show and so many great movies over the years. Nate, unlike myself, is a huge fan of Dogtooth.
Well, we like Nate better than you now, Marshall.
Apparently, yes. I also wanted to write you a list of all the movies you've introduced me to, but now I'm realizing I should do a top five film spotting discoveries with a lot of honorable mentions. I'll save that for my next donation.
That would be great if you did, Marshall. Not just donate, but we love the fact that you might include your top five film spotting discoveries. We get those emails fairly frequently, and we do often feature them here during this segment with your donations. But I think that's something I'd love to do more of. I'd really love if every listener, when they do donate, there's usually on PayPal, there is a block for notes. You can put in some kind of note. Obviously, this is where we get these comments most often. And I'd love for you to go ahead and include one or two titles, or more if you want, that you really think of as Film Spotting Discoveries. Never would have heard of that film if it wasn't for this show. Those are always fun for us to
Yeah, do. That would make an interesting list. I'd like to see that.
Let's get to some $5 a month donors, new subscribers, Marin in Stuttgart, Germany, Greg in L.A., and James from Pimlico, London, who sent us a really interesting note about his trials in the Hollywood film biz. He's come out the other side, and as you'll hear from this note, he's managed to come up with something pretty special, I think.
Your podcast, however, was and is a welcome reminder of the gems hidden among the detritus of what original and forward-thinking filmmakers we have all around us. It just takes those select few to find and champion them. I therefore thought it high time I pledged my show of support by becoming a $5 a month donor. I'm now back in London and have started up my own arts and culture publication called Fourth and Main Journal. We launched our first biannual publication back in March, featuring a selection of young actors, artists, musicians, and writers. The next issue out in September sees features with film spotting favorite Steve James, a retrospective on the great Terrence Malick.
Also a film spotting favorite.
Yeah, we like him. Profiles of actors Ben Whishaw and Britt Marling.
Also a film spotting favorite.
There you go. And a piece on the future of the British film industry. We've also launched an online magazine and are producing short films. Busy guy. We've since somehow managed to film director Werner Herzog, artist Alex Prager, actress Haley Atwell, and many more.
We're a small startup of only two people, so I'd be truly indebted to you if you wouldn't mind throwing out a quick plug to Film Spotting Nation and making people aware of our little project. Consider it done. It sounds fascinating. Keep up the great work there, James. And we will link to some of those videos and more about the Fourth and Main Journal over in the show notes at filmspotting.net. And we do want to thank, of course, all of our $2, $5, and $10 a month donors here on Film Spotting. We close with one final donation, Josh.
Eric from Racine, Wisconsin.
All right. Thank you so much, Eric, and thank you again to everyone who donated.
Sleep well in your beds, because if this thing comes true, there ain't going to be any more.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. And as if Jeff Nichols and Take Shelter hasn't got enough love on this show, that's all you're going to hear of it here on this episode as we get to our top five stormy weather movies. This has to be the Take Shelter memorial list. That's it. We're moving on. We love that film. Enough said. This list is inspired by Beasts of the Southern Wild, where Hurricane Katrina is obviously a central part of that movie. Very vicious storm that rolls through, changes everything about the story and the lives of those characters. So these are movies similar to that that have, I think we can say, storms at the core of the film. A couple quick notes before you set up the list, Josh. We've already done our top five Damn It's Hot movies here on Film Spotting. We did it last summer. So movies like Do the Right Thing and 12 Angry Men, not really working here. Not stormy weather, just hot weather. We've already done that
no
list.
Heat waves.
No heat waves. We will also probably at some point do movies that just deal with rain. Mm-hmm. There are some great films, and I'm not going to name them now because they're going to make my list in the future, that have rain as a central component. It's really almost a character in the film. That's also ruled out. These have to be fairly violent storms. We'll also note that The Wizard of Oz, one of the most famous bits of stormy weather, the tornado, and cinema history, is in the film spotting pantheon. So The Wizard of Oz, ineligible for this top five. Josh, how did you form your list?
Well, yeah, and even The Wizard of Oz might not have made it because we kind of wanted this to be not just one big scene.
Right.
But we wanted the storm to be this persistent threat or this presence and definitely have thematic resonance. So I tried my best to make these fit. I think most of them did.
Fair enough. Number five.
Key Largo. I mentioned there was one movie I was really looking forward to seeing when this topic came up because I never had seen it, and it was this 1948 effort from director John Huston. Turns out it's not the greatest movie, at least I don't think so, but it certainly has great use of a hurricane to heighten the intensity of the story. Humphrey Bogart plays a World War II vet who pays a visit to the widow and father of one of the men who died under his command. The widow is played by Lauren Bacall. Now, she and the father run a hotel on Key Largo, and when Bogart's Frank gets there, he finds it's been taken over by gangster Johnny Rocco, played by Edward G. Robinson.
So I won't get away with it, huh? How many times I heard that from dumb coppers, I couldn't count.
I still say it. He'd give you a left eye to nail me, wouldn't you? Huh? You can see the headlines, can't you? Local deputy captured Johnny Rocco. Your picture had been in all the papers. You might even get the tell on the newsreel how you pulled it off. Yeah. Well, listen, Hick. I was too much for any big city police force to handle. They tried, but they couldn't.
But the United States government had been a rap on me.
Yeah, and they won't make it stick. You Hick. I'll be back pulling strings to get guys elected mayor and governor before you ever get a 10-buck raise.
So this turns into a power struggle. That's essentially what the film is. And this is all taking place with the backdrop of an approaching hurricane, or as Bacall calls it, the big blow. I liked how one of Rocco's henchmen describes a hurricane here. He says the wind blows so hard, the ocean gets up on its hind legs and walks right across the land. Hmm. There's some great dialogue in here and a lot of references to the storm. I also liked how the scene when the storm hits, it kind of closes everyone together into this hotel, so they're doubly trapped. There's even the moment you see in storm movies where the shutters are pulled closed, mm-hmm. and usually that's supposed to give us a sense of protection when that happens, but here it only increases the claustrophobia. So a lot of intensity is brought to this movie just by virtue of the storm being there.
Well, I'm so glad Key Largo made one of our lists because I think we would have really heard from listeners based on responses, early responses from Twitter and Facebook. That movie seemed to come up a lot. I'm with you. I definitely did try to focus on movies where the storm was a constant factor, or at least there was some threat kind of hanging over the entire story. The one exception to my rule, and that's why it's at number five, is Steamboat Bill Jr., a Buster Keaton silent film. And I'm including it. I think it's worthy of this list because it's so pioneering and so kind of amazing just to watch how the storm plays out. The last 10 minutes or so of this film for a 1928 silent film, Buster Keaton plays the son of a steamer captain who's fallen on hard times. He really needs his son's help, thinks he's going to help turn the business around, but he hasn't seen his son since he was a really young boy, and he shows up and he's kind of this effete, intellectual looking guy wearing a beret or something, and he doesn't know how to really deal with his son. And it turns out he's also the boy's in love with his rival's daughter. So most of the film deals with that story and not the film. But the last 10 minutes or so is this stunning cyclone sequence where Buster Keaton gets to play the hero and rescue all the key players. And it's a pretty amazing story. It was supposed to end with a big flood sequence, but in 1927, there was a Mississippi River flood, and it seemed like it was hitting too close to home, and they turned it into this cyclone on pretty short notice, and they set up this elaborate sequence with these streets and a riverbank and all these wind machines blowing through. And you watch Buster Keaton in this film, it's pretty breathtaking. Even at one point, he gets lifted up by a tree as he's hanging on to it, flying through the air into the water. It's amazing stuff. It really doesn't look as fake as you might expect at all. And then on top of it, it's that famous Buster Keaton shot, probably his most famous gag, where he's standing in front of a house and the front part of the house falls off on top of him, but he happens to be standing right where one of the windows are or one of the doorways are, and so it falls and he's fine. And by all accounts, pretty dangerous sequence, as you might imagine, because it could have fallen on him if he was just 1 or 2 inches over to the side. So because of its place, I guess, in terms of pioneering cinema storms, I thought it was worthy of this list. Steamboat Bill Jr. is my number five.
always love it when Keaton makes a list. Actually, Dana Stevens on our 400th show mentioned one of his films in a similar scene, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, 1 Week actually does have a sequence just like this one. It was shot 8 years earlier, and he pulled it off on a smaller scale. So I think Steamboat Bill Jr. is the more famous sequence, but you're right. I think Dana did acknowledge that scene in particular during that top five, things we learned from the movie. So
there you go.
Your number four, Josh.
My number four is Shutter Island. There is a crazy and creepy vibe to this 2010 Scorsese thriller about a U.S. Marshal played by Leonardo DiCaprio, who's investigating a disappearance on an island facility for the criminally insane. And much of that vibe comes from the weather. The storm here takes the form almost of a three-act play, how Scorsese uses it. The early threat kind of adds to the sense of foreboding that this film really has. I love how this film opens the first maybe 20 minutes or so. And then when the storm hits, it kind of amps up the level of craziness right at the right moment when the story is at its most insane.
They're experimenting on people here. I don't know, boss. How do you believe a crazy guy?
That's the beauty of it, isn't it? Crazy people, they're the perfect subjects. They talk, nobody listens. I stood at Dachau. We saw what human beings are capable of doing to each other, right? For Christ's sakes, we fought a goddamn war to stop them, and now I find out it may be happening here, on our soil?
No. So what are you really here to do, Ted?
I'm gonna get the proof. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to blow the lid off this place. That's it.
Then there's the aftermath, and there are tree limbs scattered everywhere. The patients are running loose, so the storm still kind of has this presence, even though it's over, and it lets us know that there's going to be no calm after this storm. The insanity is indeed going to linger. I was at first unsure of how to reconcile the slick showmanship of Scorsese's style with the dark places that this movie eventually goes. But I did eventually come around to appreciating it as an exploration really of post-traumatic stress disorder in returning vets. DiCaprio's character is another World War II vet, actually, like Bogart. So, yeah, Shutter Island, really good film, great use of a storm.
I think made my top 20 or 25 of that year, but not that high up. Was it one of your favorites?
It was one of my top 10, yeah.
Really?
Yep.
So you were really a fan of Shutter Island. There's certainly a lot of interesting things going on in that film, as you might expect from Scorsese and the way the storm is used. I'm with you completely. My number four stormy weather movie is one I think I like a lot more than you, to go in contrast to your Shutter Island pick. It's the 2007 Frank Darabont adaptation of the Stephen King novella, I believe, The Mist, where a freak storm suddenly ushers in a species of bloodthirsty creatures in this small town, and the people of the town end up holding themselves up in a supermarket to fight for their lives, though they end up mostly fighting each other while trying to survive the bloodthirsty creatures outside.
Something in the mist! Shut the doors! Shut the doors!
The only way we're going to help ourselves is to seek rescue.
Tie this around your waist?
Before.
Well, let us know you got at least 300 feet.
There's nothing out there. Nothing in the mist.
What if you're wrong?
Then I guess the Chuck would be on me.
I think it's fair to say it qualifies as a B movie, but I'll call it a B-plus movie. Like almost all good horror films, there's a lot of allegorical applications to it. If you watch it, you can't help but think about post-9/11 fear-mongering, the war in Iraq. I like the way it was shot in a little bit of a documentary style, where it's really subtle, it's handheld but not too shaky, and there's a lot of close-ups, and there's some really good sequences early on where you feel like there are multiple cameras capturing the action, and it cuts between them really swiftly, really gracefully. I also respect any movie that has the nerve to suggest that the only thing more dangerous than the giant flying bugs outside is a room full of people, especially when they're scared and they're led by a religious zealot, in this case, Marcia Gay Harden. So there's some great satire, or at least commentary, on human nature that I think works in this film. And I'll just say, if you haven't seen The Mist, I did at the time really struggle with the ending. I'd like to see the film again. I've heard that King's story is more open-ended. This ending is definitely not open-ended. I actually, at the time we reviewed it on the show, said I hated it because I was so invested, I think, in the story that then for the ending to be as dark and cynical as it is, I applauded it for taking that risk, but at the same time, it almost felt a little bit more like a gotcha type of ending. It relies so much on timing that somehow it did throw me off a little bit. And like I said, felt like a little bit more of a, hey, we gotcha, felt like a trick. And that bothered me. But if I saw it again, I don't know if I'd feel that way.
Yeah, I think I would have liked The Mist a little more if it remained just a B picture. It got a little preachy and self-important for me. That was kind of my problem.
I like that with my B movie. So.
All right, my number three is The Ice Storm, which is probably, speaking of preachy, the most heavy-handed use of the storm as a metaphor, at least of the ones on my list. But it's still a poetic one, especially in the hands of director Ang Lee. This is Lee's splintering of the myth of the infallible nuclear family, set during the 1970s, with the Nixon scandal, speaking of fallibility, in the background. It centers on two well-off suburban families who are desperately searching for ways to make emotional connections. There's key parties, there's affairs, drugs, all sorts of sexual experimentation, but somehow it's all left them feeling more hollow. And during all this, during one of these neighborhood parties, actually, an ice storm hits. And so it does serve as the perfect metaphor for the frigidity of these lives, and also helps lead to a tragic climax. Again, I could see how you might say it's a little obvious use of it, but it is beautiful both visually, and I think it does work as a good metaphor. And looking this up again, I didn't realize, I'd forgotten who was all in this thing. I mean, there's Kevin Klein, Joan Allen, Sigourney Weaver.
Tobey Maguire,
Christina Ricci, Elijah Wood, Katie Holmes. I mean, a really rich cast here in a very good film.
Yeah, I like The Ice Storm, but it's funny. I think it's come up on the show before. For lack of a better word, it left me a little bit icy. There is something a little bit detached about it. Again, haven't seen it since I saw it on video back when it came out, but there was something about it that held me away, and I respected it a lot more than I really was into it.
Sure.
So it's another one I need to see again. You're listening to Film Spotting. Josh Larson and Adam Kempinar sharing our top five stormy weather movies, a tie-in with the new film Beasts of the Southern Wild that has Hurricane Katrina as a central figure in that movie. And it's also a central figure in my number three pick, which is a documentary called Trouble the Water. Came out, Josh, do you know the year? 2007 or 2008,
I believe.
2008. It was Oscar nominated. Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl are the filmmakers, and the film opens just days before the central figures in the story are an aspiring rapper and her husband. And it's when they meet the filmmakers, but then it goes back a couple weeks when the storm hit, and we see their home movie footage, them documenting what's happening to them as the storm hits.
Oh, Jesus! This is my face. After just opening my back door, who be with us, Lord, please? Man, I'm talking about niggas gonna take a dip if they want.
They're fascinating characters. Obviously, their tale of survival is really fascinating, and just how they try to put their lives together after the storm hits. And of course, just seeing that footage, that 15 minutes or so of footage that we see referenced multiple times throughout the film from the actual storm is really harrowing. And for that reason alone, I think this film needs to be seen. But of course, as you watch it, the film becomes about a lot more things than just this couple. It does become a larger exploration of race and class, and of course, the government's response or lack of response to this crisis. I looked over their IMDb page. I was really curious if Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl had been making any other films, or if there was something we could expect. And from what I could tell, Carl Diehl doesn't have a whole lot going on. Tia Lesson worked a lot with Michael Moore and was a consulting producer recently on Martin Scorsese's George Harrison documentary, Living in the Material World. Again, I'm not really sure what Carl Diehl is doing, if he's still making films, but I really do wonder if they'll ever work as a team again, or if you wonder if this was one of those isolated incidents where this subject matter dovetailed perfectly with their lives and it was a story they had to tell. I guess that remains to be seen, but Trouble the Water is a really fascinating documentary. My number three.
My number two might be the one that's actually a little bit of a cheat. It's Bambi. There's only one storm, and it actually kind of is a rainstorm, but I'm sneaking it in.
Okay.
Because weather of all forms is a force in this animated landmark. It kind of works as a nature documentary, is one way of looking at Bambi. Bambi, of course, traces the first year in the life of a young fawn, and it's this entrancing combination of animated naturalism and impressionism. It kind of goes back and forth throughout the movie. Included in this is the little April shower sequence, which begins so naturally. There's this crash of thunder, and then Bambi scurries into one of the movie's intricately detailed thickets. But then it takes a creative turn as the drops start to fall, each one accompanied by a different light note on the soundtrack.
Thank you. Well, I'm glad we both had somewhat of a cheat on our list.
I had to balance
Bambi,
it out.
I think Bambi certainly works. My number two pick is my second horror film, and my second horror film with characters in a confined space. But I could not leave off The Shining, where the snow and the temperature, inclement weather in general, drives everything about this story. Jack Nicholson's character takes the job at the Overlook, which is already isolated and abandoned in the winter because it gets so cold and the snow makes it so difficult to get to. So there's already a fear of these characters going stir crazy because you're basically trapped. But then a storm hits and they're really trapped. And it makes it impossible to get in or out. And of course, that end sequence in the maze is ridiculously scary. It scared me back when I was a kid and I saw it, and I just recently rewatched it for this list on YouTube, and the camera burrowing through the maze, the howl of the wind, the frost, the snow, intercutting it with Shelley Duvall as she's searching the hotel for her son. We get the elevator bloodbath. It's
stop already, okay? Just
it's
stop.
Amazing filmmaking. Stanley Kubrick, he knew what he was doing. I think we can say that, but the threat of that hangs over every aspect of that film. This notion of, okay, you're already stuck there, but what if the weather really makes us stuck there? And of course, we see how that plays out. So The Shining had to make my list at number two.
I would have put it on mine, except I was just too plain scared to do it.
There you go.
Instead, my number one is a film you already mentioned, Trouble the Water, and you captured exactly what this movie captured, which was some really amazing footage. Not only these biblical floods and the astonishing wreckage, but also the infuriating governmental indifference and the ensuing bureaucratic nightmare. It's powerful stuff here, especially when Kimberly Roberts, the main figure, unleashes her anger and disillusionment in this pyrotechnic impromptu performance of spoken word verse. I love that scene. I think this is one reason why I appreciated Beasts of the Southern Wild so much. I see it very much of a piece with something like this in the way that it tackles issues such as displacement, disenfranchisement. Obviously, Beast is using an entirely different language, but still some of the same themes coming through.
Yeah, I think it's certainly appropriate, as I said, for this show that would be the one film that showed up on both of our lists. It's a really fascinating movie, Trouble the Water. My number one, I think I'll say this before I read a little bit of a description about it. All other cases on my list, Steamboat aside, the other three big movies where weather is just a dominant character in the film, they're all cases where the weather really drives the action. It really pushes the story forward. And with my number one pick, it's there throughout the movie, but it really provides more context for the story or embellishes or adds layers of meaning. And before I say the title of the film, I actually just want to go ahead and read this great description that I couldn't do better than. It comes from a writer named David Ng, writing at imagesjournal.com. Nothing is rewarded and everything is punished in a world devoid of divine intervention. And yet God is everywhere in this movie. He's certainly in the battle scenes, which Kurosawa has filmed with a kind of omniscient detachment. He's also in the weather, gentle at first, then increasingly stormy as brother fights brother, and ultimately hurricane force as Hidetora goes insane and wanders the wilderness with his fool. This is all punctuated by large, billowing clouds that Kurosawa frequently cuts to as if to emphasize the immateriality of it all. Yes, the immateriality of it all. Clouds finally give way to a red sunset as the death toll mounts, and we are left with complete destruction in the movie's final scenes. That is a description of a masterpiece from Akira Kurosawa, 1985's Ron, which is an update, which is a telling of Shakespeare's King Lear story. And I don't know how I can top the way that writer David Ng summed it up, the way the weather plays such a dominant role in this film. Again, not really about pushing the story forward. It's there more telling us about the inner turmoil, and it's there to add this kind of thematic resonance to the story as a whole. And Kurosawa was a master, so Ron's my number one.
Really, three of his films could have been considered for this list, at least three, Rashomon or Seven Samurai.
Rainy.
Maybe those are both too rainy.
Yep.
But Ron, perfect. Yeah, I like that a lot.
What about any honorable mentions, Josh?
I had A Serious Man as a possibility, but again, that was kind of one scene in particular. And also Mouchette There's a lot of rain in there, and it really plays an integral part.
A storm is a key part.
Yeah, a storm that plays an integral part in how the plot moves forward there. And also, I thought about Swept Away just because I alarmed so many people last week
when I mentioned it again.
An honorable mention.
The Guy Ritchie debacle.
There's a storm in there, though.
They were swept away by it.
Exactly.
So I haven't
swept
seen
away.
It. Another, somehow I know.
Between last week and now, you haven't rushed out to... Oh,
no,
Adam.
No,
come on.
That's
priorities.
Not going to happen. I'm with you that as I considered a few honorable mentions, Mouchette came up. I did throw in some here that were singular storm movies. They play a big part in the film, but that constant threat isn't there. Black Narcissus, the film from the Archers, Powell and Pressburger. Master and Commander. I love that film.
Yeah.
Peter Weir's movie. That has a huge storm at sea that's a lot of fun to watch. Also, one of my all-time favorite films, a movie that should be in the film spotting pantheon, frankly, the silent movie Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans.
Mm-hmm.
Key storm sequence at the end of that film as the two lovers are on the water in a boat. And then another one that I just felt like has gotten too much love already from me on this show, but the weather, the snow in particular, plays a key factor in the movie, is The Thing, the John Carpenter film, where I believe they're up at the North Pole and there is a key storm that wreaks havoc on an already havoc-filled event that's going on as this alien creature is unleashed in their midst. But the snow and the temperature is also a big part of it. So The Thing is another one I consider.
Should we get it out of the way now, since it wasn't an honorable mention for either of us, The Perfect Storm, why we didn't choose that?
I'll cop to why it's not on my list, because I've never seen it.
And it's a bad film.
Is it?
Yeah,
okay.
I think so.
Well, I wonder how many people we just infuriated with both of those comments.
I don't think
we'll see.
Too many.
I don't know if that film's
is
that
there,
beloved.
No, I don't think there's
it
a perfect storm
isn't.
Contingent.
I've never been dying to see it. So anyway, those are our top five stormy weather movies. Send us your picks or any other feedback about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, the big film that no one wants to contend with, The Dark Knight Rises, directed by Christopher Nolan. I think we can safely summarize and say we both recommend it.
Definitely.
Okay. In limited release, Farewell, My Queen. This is a film that has the great Diane Kruger. I really love Diane Kruger.
The great, huh?
I would say that.
Elevating her to great.
She's great in Inglourious Basterds, the Tarantino film.
Oh.
She plays Marie Antoinette in this film. Trishna is out. We referenced it last week. It's the new film from Michael Winterbottom, an update of Tessa the D'Urbervilles from Thomas Hardy, not the actor, the writer. And finally, Ruby Sparks, the new film from the team that gave us Little Miss Sunshine. Am I correct in
yes.
saying that? Ruby Sparks, also out in limited release, opening here in Chicago. Next week on the show, we're really considering Trishna. We haven't completely ruled it out, but right now...
Oh, that's still in play.
Well, I'm willing to be twisted and pulled in a direction.
We'll talk.
But as it turns out, I just really think I need something a little bit lighter, and Ruby Sparks would be lighter. And I think it gives us a nice top five, Josh, which is movies about writers. Somehow we've never actually done that. There are a fair number of films that deal with characters who are authors, not screenwriters. We're not going to talk about screenwriters because that's just a whole separate Hollywood top five. But movies about writers is our plan. And we're also going to finally get back to our contemporary Iranian cinema marathon.
Yes.
That next film is The Mirror.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. Our featured artist was Japandroids. You can learn more about them at japandroids.com.
Rock Pitchfork last weekend, Rainy Pitchfork, and because they were getting so much attention from that festival, I decided to listen to them, and they're really good.
All right, and we also want to say a big thanks again to Michael Phillips and A.O. Scott for joining us.
That was really fun.
It
I'm
was
so glad
cool.
we were able to get them on the show together. Obviously, they have great chemistry, and maybe we can talk them into it sometime. Maybe, actually, sometime we can take a week off, and
Ooh.
Let's get those two together
I
to
like
host
that.
Film spotting.
I like that a lot.
Of course, there are a lot of people out there right now saying, yeah, just get them to replace
do
you
that
guys.
Permanently.
Full time.
Yeah, on second thought, maybe we don't want to do that.
Maybe not.
For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
For a little bit longer, anyway, I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Meteorological. I should have taken that out.
But it's so impressive if you're able to say it.
Meteorological.
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 Drop the O.
Okay, I'm going to drop the O.
But first, what are you?
I'm Christopher Nolan's Reckoning.
That sounded very accurate.
I wonder if you can hear it.
I'm I'm Christopher Nolan's reckoning.
Let me try it again.
I think that's what they did.
Yeah.
When they did the re-recording of all his dialogue, he just put his hands in front of his face.
So this time I'm going to do it, and then I'm going to say, like, and I'll listen to you.
You don't know how stupid I am.
What are you doing? What are you doing?
You'll get it.
Okay, hold on.